Welcome to Movie Dumpster Season 7, Episode 3. Today we're talking about Ragdoll from 1999, directed by Ted Nicolau. And we're going to tell you why this flick is a great 90s black independent horror film that's definitely worth checking out. I'm Joel Escola.
I'm Sean O'Rourke.
I'm Jared Hornbeck.
And I'm Steve Guntley.
Welcome to The Dumpster. So here we are, Sean. We're back for February. We did a little bit of lovey-dovey stuff for the beginning. We got a little bit back to that because, you know,
I guess you could call My Bloody Valentine lovey-dovey.
I think so.
Well, Hollis and his girlfriend, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little in and out going somewhere. You know, we got the hearts and the chocolates and all the bullshit roses and stuff out of the way. But now we're back. We're talking about more blaxploitation stuff.
Yep, for Black History Month.
And we usually do that. And we have been doing that for like the past 3 years. And we've done a lot of Rudy Ray Moore stuff. We've done
Pam Grier
stuff. We've done both Blackula movies, which Pam Grier's in one of those.
Oh, yeah. not as good one, but
no.
Yes.
But we talked about Tales from the Hood, and we talked about Bones, and those are going to be coming up today too, especially in the kind of the resurgence of the urban horror movie for the early 90s, mid 90s into the 2000s and beyond.
I mean, we're going to talk about that, but that is what Full Moon, or the company that was Full Moon in air quotes.
Alchemy
definitely was throwing that on there, and they were definitely trying to get into that market. And there's even Ted Nicolau kind of talks about that in the Video Zone you can find on YouTube. It's kind of interesting.
We'll get to that in a second. Yeah. But yeah, before we get into the voodoo that you do so well, if you want some more Movie Dumpster content, you can head over to patreon.com/moviedumpster. You can get an ad-free audio version of the show for only $2 a month, and you can support the show.
And if you're watching this episode here on YouTube, please leave a like down on the video and share it with your friends. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast app, leave us that 5-star review. It really does help get us out of the bottom of the dumpster into more eardrums, eyeballs, and everything in between.
It sure does. And if you want to keep up with the Dumpster Boys' whereabouts, you can head over to moviedumpsterpodcast.com and you can see our whole schedule and what shows we're going to be at. We got Monster Mania and Cherry Hill coming up in March, and we got Tapes from the Crypt coming up in April on 420, baby. Smoke them if you got them. So let's introduce our guests, because we did see them at the beginning. What's up? We got Jared and we got Steven here from the Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks podcast. What is up, guys?
Oh, we're doing great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're excited about this because Steve and I came up to the conclusion together that if we cover a movie on a different show, we are striking it from the record on our show. It was kind of like, it was nice because I'm watching Ragdoll and I'm thinking like, I can't wait to talk about this movie. And then I'm like, but we don't have to cover it again, which is kind of nice. And we made that decision. We were on another show, Neon Brainiacs, doing Creepazoids.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And we were like, all right, well, Creepazoids is out there. We're not going to do it again. And it's nice to know. And it's kind of nice to be able to talk about these on Full Moon Movies on someone else's show and have a lot less of the responsibility.
Yeah, we straight up just stole the idea from our friend Doug from the Good Times Great Movies podcast, who kind of established that. He's like, if I appear on another podcast talking about a movie that's on our list, then I don't have to cover it anymore. It's a good way of kind of like outsourcing, just sort of sharing the love. The podcasting community is very communal.
Absolutely, man. Tell us a little bit about your show.
So about a year ago, I'm going to say probably about exactly a year ago.
Yeah, coming up.
Steve and I were having a conversation. We were talking and it came like we knew that the other person had read It Came from the Video Aisle. And we both realized we were the one other person in the continental United States who read that book. So we were like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And so
this guy over here did too. Yeah.
Yay, there we go.
So we were like, man, there's just so many movies, so many stories. It's just wild how these low budget companies operate. And then Charles Band's autobiography had just come out. And we were saying to each other, like, we got to grab that Confessions of a Puppet Master and read that as well. And the idea kind of just came into my head where I was like, man, I wonder if anybody has done a show where they tackle all these movies. And so I looked it up and there wasn't really one. I think someone had the idea, started it and gave up after like episode 3.
Yeah,
it was
something
like three
that.
Archived episodes from a couple of years ago. And I was like, okay, cool. No one's doing it. And then I kind of just handed it over to Steve as half a joke, but then
It was kind of something we were resisting for a while, because it's like, oh man, we're gonna have to watch a lot of movies if we do this. And I think after the autobiography came out, that just sort of hit the tipping point. We're like, all right, we're just gonna do this. So basically the premise of our show is that we watch every movie from the Full Moon catalog, and then we expanded that to also encompass the Empire International, so we can go back to some cool stuff in the 80s. We're talking about Torchlight, we're talking about Moonbeam, we're talking about Alchemy, which we're here to talk about a little bit today. Basically, anything that Charles Band has touched at this point is up for grabs on this series. So we've been digging into just a little bit of everything from high horror to low horror to very, very middle horror. We're going to be talking about all the works of Stuart Gordon, and then all the Puppet Master movies, all of the subspecies films.
Well, that
so
was
many
our
weird
thing
ones.
Was we started and we were like, okay, cool. So it's Full Moon. Like, yeah, there's a lot of Full Moon movies. But then we were like, oh, that's a bummer. We won't get to talk about Reanimator, and we won't get to talk about From Beyond. And we won't. And then it was like, oh, well, we can make it Empire. Yeah, but then we can't talk about Tourist Trap. And so we have to make it anything that Charles Band touched.
We kind of just kept expanding on it. I think like by our very narrow definition, we're going to be covering the movie Freeway. So I'm just excited. I think it was mostly just like, we want to twist things around so we have an excuse to talk about Freeway. We want to twist things around so we have an excuse to talk about Tourist Trap. So we found a way. Life finds a way.
Yeah, for every like Evil Bong 666 that we're going to cover, we need something like Freeway. our sanity. Yeah, for
sure. Need a nice.
Well, we were on your show for talk about something that we need our sanity return.
Well,
that's
from, for sure.
Demonic Toys 2. Holy shit!
Oh, yes. We're going to be talking about that. Yeah,
I still can't get over that film.
Yeah, that was still one of the lower ranked movies that we've talked about. That was kind
there
of
there are
slog.
A couple of past hosts who we've legitimately apologized to, and I feel like we have to add you guys maybe to that list.
Yeah,
you don't have to apologize, because I'm the one who suggested it. So,
truth comes out.
So I'll put myself right in the frying pan for that. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. You did. Yeah, we didn't saddle you with that one. That was self-inflicted for sure.
I'm glad I watched it. Well, go check out their episode to hear my full thoughts.
Well, we tried to parallel it because we had done Demonic Toys on the show already. So I was like, oh, let's do Demonic Toys 2 with the podcast that's doing all the Full Moon and Charles Band stuff.
Sure.
So why not? That seemed like a good fit. But yeah, that's so awesome that you guys are covering the full pantheon of the Charles Band universe. And we have tackled a bunch of stuff. We had a whole event for Fallen Empire, which was all the Empire movies that we covered. We did a lot. We've done some Full Moon stuff. We've done some Moonbeam stuff. And we talked about it on your show, and we talked about it on our show a lot, but the Full Moon and Charles Band stuff is so close to my heart. Grew up with all that stuff. And I guess, by saying that, I want to segue into Ragdoll in terms of, like, is this y'all's first time watching this movie?
Yeah, this was a first time watch for me.
This is my first, second, and third time watching this movie.
Oh, there you go.
I did get two viewings in myself, but yes, also my first viewing.
I mean, I'm sure we were all video store kids here, but like this was one that I remember it coming out and it being this brand new thing. And this is kind of the beginning of the end for Full Moon into the 2000s. Cause we get, so Alchemy joins the Full Moon universe, and we get Ragdoll, and we get Killjoy, and we get the horrible Dr. Bones, and we get the vault and all that stuff. And I remember them all coming out at that time. And I was like, great, more Little Rubber Monster movies for little Joey in 1999. I was like, this is great. And I remember it being really good, like better than I thought it was going to be. And again, on the rewatch, it's just like really, really good.
I mean, we're going to talk about it, but yeah, it really surprised me, honestly.
For what it is, right?
Oh, yeah.
For a Full Moon movie made in the late 90s, we're coming up on the 2000s, and we talked about things like Doll Graveyard and stuff in passing on your guys' show, and it you know, it goes downhill. There's a big dip that happens in those 2000s, but Full Moon is coming back.
Sure. If you've been watching the show for a while or even listening back in the day, you know how I feel about a lot of these films, and I try to go in with an open mind, but they rarely land for me. This one did land. I mean, Empire stuff a little bit more so, but Full Moon's a very, it's a shotgun blast for me usually, like a little Puppet Master, but the rest is like, I don't know what the fuck's going on.
A little scattershot for you, yeah.
But yeah, so this one kind of struck a chord.
Yeah.
This came out at a very weird time for Full Moon, you know, where they started life kind of as a subsidiary of Paramount, and then Paramount got kind of sick of the low quality of the movies and severed their deal. And so Full Moon was just kind of a free agent, so to speak. You know, they had some various partners and various sources of funding, but this is the period of time where Charles Band is kind of the most unhinged and the most creatively free flowing. There's a real don't give a fuck attitude about a lot of the movies from like between like, I would say Head of the Family and Blood Dolls, you know, like there's this little mm-hmm. stretch in here where he just seems to be having a really good time being as weird and free flowing as he can.
And I've generally really enjoyed this period. Like some of the Kushner-Locke stuff that we've watched. I mean, we haven't covered Head of the Family on the show yet, but Head of the Family is a personal favorite of mine in the
great
Full
one.
Moon oeuvre. And yeah, with Blood Dolls was a surprise. It was one that I kind of had never seen, had kind of avoided based solely on the cover. I watched it for the episode we did with the Dolls of Horror, and Steve and I both loved it, and
yeah.
it
yeah.
shot right kind of to the top of our rankings of Full Moon movies, right up there in our kind of top five.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's other ones like we released a couple weeks ago, probably a couple months ago, maybe by the time this airs, an episode on The Creeps. And
oh, yeah.
that was a super fun one. And I think you're right, Steve. I think this is just a period where it's like the Paramount deal soured, and it was less like, let's make really specific genre type movies, because the Paramount stuff, I think you look at Subspecies, like these are vampire movies. You look at Oblivion, you're like, this is like a cool space Western movie.
Yeah.
But they really weren't bound by any real genre limitations in the Kushner-Locke era. And so there's just some wild stuff coming out in this time. And I'm really happy to hear that this one landed for you guys too, because this was a first time watch for me. And full disclosure, I mean, this is a cheap movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
There's no looking at, you know, how this thing looks on screen. And I feel like that will take your average moviegoer out of the movie almost instantaneously with the way that this thing looks. Shot on film, shot on tape, but high-end tape. Kind of looking like a film at times and looking like a soap opera at other times. And like, it's... you have to just sort of go into it knowing that this is an incredibly cheap movie shot in about 2.5 weeks. And given that, this movie is pretty good.
I think yeah. it's great. And like you said, it shot on digital. And that was something I was trying to tell you.
Yeah, because we were talking earlier. About that off air. It might even been on one of our live shows.
Yeah.
But just like when I had looked up trailers, I'm like, you say shot on video. And maybe, again, I'm like a little ignorant about this, to be perfectly clear.
Well, usually when I say SOV or shot on video, we're talking about stuff like
Sledgehammer
or violent shit movies. But
got
like
ya.
This is...
well, clearly a step above what you would expect with a lot of those style films.
Right. This you had prosumer kind of, not HD, but like they were better digital cameras time. But I don't know what they shot it on exactly.
It looks good.
But it's video. You know, it's not film.
Yeah, I would say this one has held up better. Like there's a real hit or miss kind of quality to some of the restorations of these. And early digital, like early digital video from like late 90s, mid 2000s is the hardest stuff in the world to look at if it hasn't been yeah. restored or properly upkept. I think this Ragdoll one looks pretty good. Like recently we did a double episode on the first two Ginger Dead Man movies. And the first one looks like absolute dog shit. And then the second one's been like restored and kind of looks nice. And it's like, all right. I mean, nice is all in air quotes for these movies, but you know.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. It's a cut above the rest because there's a lot of great lighting and staging in this movie and a lot of great even like camera moves and stuff like that. It's a low budget, but it still has the flair of Full Moon movie. You know what I mean? They were like top tier, the low budget direct video stuff at the time. For this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mel Johnson Jr. came in to do in the deal with Charles Band starting Alchemy as this subsidiary. And what I think is really cool about that is, you know, blaxploitation has existed for a long time, but they were really interested in like, let's get these I hate saying the word urban, so I'm going to use air quotes while I say it. But they were like, we're going to tell these urban stories, and we're going to have them be starring primarily people of color, made by primarily people of color. Now, in this instance, it's not, but it is produced, and it is sort of there are people of color behind the scenes, and telling these stories. And we talked about it in our Killjoy episode, how even though that movie was cheap and didn't quite hold up in ways as well as I think Ragdoll does, I do think that it's really nice to get these voices behind these stories, because a lot of times, you know, blaxploitation stuff had maybe a black filmmaker and a cast of people of color, but the executive decisions coming down were not, which is different here. Mel Johnson Jr. had a big role in Alchemy here. And I can appreciate that. I can appreciate that there is an audience that this movie is really playing for. And I think everybody is kind of committed to tell a decent story. And you said that the staging in this movie, and I don't mean staging in the way of like how scenes are shot per se, but there's like a stage quality to this. It's almost like people, I think they felt, we're shooting this on the earliest digital. It's going to look like dog shit. You're not going to be able to see a lot of details. Go big with these performances.
Yeah, even the way that they shoot the doll, I really appreciate as well, because they have this great, like, almost flame light that lights its face all the time to kind of accentuate the voodoo magic and stuff, which I think is cool. But it also is kind of like, let's hide the effects a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it rides that line, but I think it's super effective.
It also just, I want to comment on that real quick, Jared, because you did bring him up, Mel Johnson Jr. I did see that. And if anyone's unfamiliar with his work, he's famously from one of my favorite movies, Total Recall. He's Benny, the cab driver. Yeah.
Okay. I did not put that together. That's who that is. That's so cool.
He's got five kids to feed, guys.
Steve also did not put another thing together, which we came to the realization of via text message when I was watching the movie, I think for the second time, where Steve was commenting on it saying like, hey, you know, I'm really enjoying this watch of Ragdoll. And I was like, yeah, there's nothing that I love more than watching Mr. Johnson from Abbott Elementary dancing alone in a club.
I did not piece that together at all. And then I thought that was so cool because he's playing Big Pear, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Big Pear.
Yeah. So real quick, this movie's directed by Ted Nicolau, and he is Empire Full Moon alumni, right? I mean, this is the guy behind Terror Vision and the Subspecies movies and even some Moonbeam stuff. He did like Dragon World and Leaping Leprechauns that we covered.
Yep.
And it's always great to see Ted, because Ted is such a sweet dude. Like, I got a chance to meet him, and he's just very passionate about the projects that he works on, which is really great. And it comes through here too.
Yeah, we would be remiss to say that by the time around the time this is probably going to air, we will have an hour long episode that is just an interview with Ted Nicolau dropping.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Yeah, it's awesome. Definitely go check that out.
Yeah, it should be dropping around the same time. And he was such a sweetheart and so gracious with his time. And he was amazing. And I can't wait to get that one out there, because we had some cast members from the Subspecies sequels on for an interview, but they couldn't, Ted wasn't available at the same time. And I feel like we've sort of established a real reverence for those movies. And so it was really fun to like do a Subspecies 2 proper episode, then release the interview with the cast members, and then talk to Ted about Subspecies 2, which is one of our favorite Full Moon movies. And he was just amazing, and it'll be coming out probably around the time that you're hearing this. So jump over to our Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever and see if that's there, because he's just got a ton of great stories to tell. Because like you said, Joe, he was involved really from the beginning. I mean, from recording sound on Texas Chainsaw Massacre to editing Tourist Trap and all of those things. I mean, he's been along for the ride.
Man's great. Absolute legend. It's written by Neil Marshall Stevens.
Oh.
Now, this guy has two other surnames. What are they? Or pseudonyms, rather. Roger Barron and Benjamin Carr, and he's done a fuck ton of Full Moon stuff
under these multiple names. Okay,
these multiple names,
he was Charles Band's go to like punch up guy for a couple of years there. I think throughout this period, I think he might have even done Demonic Toys too, if I remember correctly.
He did do Demonic Toys too, which is a shame because I think just by talking about Ted Nicolau, I feel like giving the right director the script can make a world of difference, especially like we just saw with Ragdoll. You know what I mean? In my opinion.
Well, it's a testament to Ted. It's like the movie was shot in, I think he said 18. There's conflicting stories. Some say 12, some say 18 days that it took to shoot this movie. But it's kind of like, hey, here's a title that's been floating around for Full Moon for a while. We have this new Alchemy Entertainment. This is what we're going for. Here's the story. Ted, you're a reliable guy, get this movie made. And he did it, you know, in an admirable way in such a short period of time with no money. And so you're absolutely right. It says a lot about him as a director.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to note too, Neil Marshall Stevens wrote some of my favorite Monsters episodes.
Huh.
And when I saw that, it totally clicked in my brain because he wrote the premiere episode, which is The Fever Man. Oh, and he did The Face, which is a really great episode, which we're going to get to on the Talks from the Dark Side show we have. But as I'm watching this, I'm like, this feels like a Monsters episode, especially because it's shot on video, too, because I feel like some of those later Monsters episodes are video.
Oh, okay.
So it kind of feels similar,
like the wires are connecting in your brain, the neurons are firing off, like, ooh, Monsters.
Just the way it's written and it feels, and even that kind of story, like I could see this truncated to 25 minutes and be an episode of Monsters.
Well, in fact, according to Wikipedia, they fucking did that.
They did that. Yeah, the Devil Dolls. That was a stretch. Like, yeah, I think starting a couple years after this time, they would start just kind of shortening and compiling a lot of the different full movies that maybe didn't hit. And so like Devil Dolls was one of those collaborations, I believe. But yeah, this one, something that we do encounter a lot on the show is like, even though these movies are 70 minutes long, most of the time, they still feel like they're sort of spinning their wheels for a little bit between like the intro and the climax. And this is a movie that actually does not feel like that. I think this is a pretty well-paced, well-scripted movie for the most part. It's got a little bit of momentum. It's got characters that you give a shit about. And it's got some actors like who are, they're trying. Like some of them are going pretty big. Some of them are, you know, pretty good. It's not a surprise that like of this cast, more of them are still working actors today than of a lot of other Full Moon movies, you know?
Yeah, sometimes when you deal with movies that are cheap like this, you run into where you have a premise and it's like, let's get this movie made, but you have actors who are maybe even like non-actors who are just sort of stumbling through line deliveries, like wooden, trying to get lines out. But that's not happening here. Like they're giving performances and I can really appreciate that. And you were saying, Steve, about the runtime, which is so funny because this is not one of the 70-minute movies. This is a 97-minute movie, which is like Gandhi of Full Moon movies.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't feel like it, you know, like it comes up all the time. We just watched the original Ginger Dead Man. That's 70 minutes flat, 20 or 55 minutes if you take out credits. And it felt like an interminable slog. And then this movie just kind of zips right past.
Gary Busey can't even save that one.
No.
Gary Busey did everything he could to actively destroy that one. Yes.
So I guess that's...
He pissed all over that hospitality, guys.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Oh, is that a Silver Bullet reference?
That's a Troll 2 reference.
It absolutely is. It's often made on this show.
Piss on him. Piss on the Ginger Dead Man.
Oh, no! He's the soggy dead man!
Based on Charles Band!
Oh, wait, I just realized I combined two things in my head. You're right, I combined the piss on hospitality from Troll 2 with Gary Busey's piss on the Yankees, piss on the whatever rant that he does.
We may have just made that joke in an episode.
That is so funny.
Welcome to the Movie Dumpster Universe, guys.
Yes, absolutely.
I often feel like I belong at the bottom of some kind of dumpster. So again, I'm always going to feel like I'm at home.
You're in your natural habitat. Yeah,
I really am.
All right, so let's get into this a little bit. So the plot of this movie is there's this rap group, KT Bounce.
Yep.
And they are putting on shows. They're doing pretty successful at this nightclub. And they get approached by this kingpin drug lord question mark.
Kinda, yeah.
Big Pear and his brothers, Big Gene and Lil Mikey. And they're basically forced against their will to sign a contract with them. So the thing is that the lead singer of KT Bounce, Kwame, his grandmother is a voodoo priestess who is basically like, yeah, you got the magic in you too. So be careful with that. They end up not signing the contract and pretty much telling Big Pear to go fuck himself on stage, which we'll get to in a second. And they put Grant in the hospital. So Kwame calls upon the Shadow Man and puts the dark magic into a rag doll, and it goes on a killing spree, Pumpkinhead style.
Literally, now that you mention it.
And of course, the crucial part about this deal with the Shadow Man is that anytime a life is taken, like of one of his enemies, he has to take the life of someone that he loves. And so, you know, it's a classic deal with the devil, kind of Faustian situation where he needs to stop this ragdoll from killing his enemies, thereby kind of forcing him to ally with Big Pear and like his gangsters, even though he doesn't really want to, you know.
Sort of.
Yeah, that seems kind of great.
You big fat motherfucker. Yeah.
Can we talk about Little Mikey?
He's my favorite character.
Oh my God.
He's so good.
Like, okay, I want to give them props for having a gay henchman character, like a gay like villain, not something that you see very often around this time. There is a big part of me that suspects that this actor was just kind of like trying out some stuff he learned at the Groundlings and just sort of, you know, trying to build out a character for himself. And Ted is just kind of like, yeah, go for it. Do your thing.
Tarnell Poindexter's his name. And from what I understand, they basically wanted to do like this mashup of like Little Richard and also be like this badass guy,
like a tough guy, kind of
like a tough guy. Guy,
yeah. It mostly works. I wonder if some people would watch this and be offended, but the character's interesting. I like the character.
I mean, it's sort of like if Marcellus Wallace was played by Titus Burgess.
Sure, yeah.
It's it works.
I think he's giving a good performance. Like, I think he's committing to the bit. I think he's finding the right line. Like, he's menacing when he needs to be menacing, and he's like funny and goofy when he needs to be funny and goofy. And I think they complement each other. Like,
absolutely, totally agree with you.
Same. I guess that's kind of what I'm saying, yeah. Too. Because like Joe said in the plot crunch, like we kind of get introduced to these characters. We do get like a very short flashback in the beginning where we're showing like the grandma basically as a little girl back in, I think it's like 1941.
Yeah, we're in New Orleans, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. New Orleans.
And fucking Princess Ozma attacks her mother.
Oh, the dress. It's a possessed
Morbi
dress.
Excuse me. Now Ozma's the little girl, but this fucking dress comes at her. That's what I thought of instantly.
I was thinking of the dress from Legend that Lily danced with and like turns, you know, puts it on.
But she kills her mother because she somehow made some kind of deal with the Shadow Man, which then puts the idea in Grant's head. Hey, don't do that. And then we flash forward to meet our actual cast of characters, which is this KT Bounce group led by Kwame.
Yeah, we got Tisha, Lewis, Jem, and Kwame. Yep. And just real quick, when they first like introduce them, they're all getting together and you kind of introduce them all. And one guy, I think it's Lewis, makes a comment to Kwame. And he's like, you Bobby Brown looking motherfucker, because he calls him ugly or something. I thought that was the funniest thing. But they all have really good chemistry, too.
Even the music, honestly, like, I don't think it's like the best thing in the world, but it like actually sounds like music at the time. Like, I feel like I'm not going to go out and buy the Big City Record, but I was kind of bopping my head. I was like, this sounds like actual music.
You and no one else, Sean. Because if we look at Big City Entertainment, I mean, this is another one of those times where like Full Moon was trying to, and Charlie Band, I should say, was trying to branch into something else, because with the Moonstone Records, which they did for Netherworld, and they had David Bryan, the keyboardist from Bon Jovi, do the score to that movie. And that I think was the inaugural release for Moonstone Records. And then you had like Bad Channels, which was trying to kind of highlight these underground bands that were kind of like grunge and metal, and that was released as a CD, and Netherworld was released as a CD, and Charlie Spradling was selling these CDs on, you know, Video Zones. And this was one where like they made the CD of this, but something got messed up in the release. It didn't come out on CD until like 6 months after this movie premiered on video. And like, when you're talking Full Moon movies, like that could be 12 movies later, and Big City kind of collapsed. And that was I think it's the only release that they had was the soundtrack to this movie.
What a shame, too, because like that was a big part of like what Alchemy was pushing, too. They're like, yeah, and we're teaming up with Big City Records by all of these bands that we're featuring and these independent black artists and stuff. So that's a shame, dude.
Yeah, but like I was saying, that they're doing this performance, and this is where you get the introduction of Little Mikey, and he's dancing all sexual. And, you know, people are like, oh, what the hell? And it's like, all right, well, I don't know what's going on with this character. But then he comes backstage. Well, actually, there's another guy first that comes back and trying to get them to sign with his company, gives them a fucking business card. And they're like, oh, man, we finally made it. And then little Mikey, like, knocks down the door like, no fucking way.
Actually, you're going to come work for Big Hair. And this is how this is going to go. He's got a little cute little cowboy hat on and a vest and stuff.
Yeah. I love, too, how he's like, you know who I am, right? And they're just, like, stunned, like, yeah. And he's like, yeah. So you're going to come with me, right? They're like, yeah.
So, like Sean was saying, they get taken into like this club, and Big Pear kind of shakes. You see Big Pear,
and bags, he's like, over their heads.
Yeah,
you think?
And he's like dancing in the middle of the club, and you're like, oh boy, what's cooking now? And they have everybody sit down, and there's this other guy there that's going to see him too, Big Pear. And Big Pear's basically like, yeah, so I got everything in this hand, money and girls and everything you could want, and I want you in there. And they're like, I don't know, you're like a fucking drug lord, and you're probably going to do something really horrible to us or something. Yeah. And he basically is just like, Kwame's like, we got to think about it. You know, we're not just going to jump in feet first with this. So they're like, all right, you think about it. And then Big Pear takes the one dude that was sitting at the bar, and they beat the shit out of this guy and dump his head in a fucking deep fryer. Yeah. Oh man, it's crazy.
I was going to say that club looks kind of like a high school, like gymnasium. And so
yeah.
it was almost like that was like the school cafeteria deep fryer that was already there. And they're like, well, we can't move this thing and get it out of the shot. So let's figure out how to include it. And they did it there, I think, in an effective way.
It's very threatening. I mean, if I saw that dude dump his head into a deep fryer, I'd be like, all right, I think this guy's going to kill us if he doesn't, if we don't sign with him.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that. But then the next day they go back on stage and Kwame's like, this song goes out to Big Pear. Go fuck yourself. More or less.
He's like this guy.
I was smiling, man. I was smiling through that scene. I mean, I knew it was coming, obviously, because it's like it has to be the inciting incident. But I thought they did something interesting here, which I think is a nod to Ted Nicolau understanding film language, maybe more than somebody making another movie with this kind of schedule and budget, which is that they really effectively go from him calling out Big Pear on stage, then still performing the same song, and yet you see Big Pear getting visibly angry. But then there's a little montage of them going to find Granny and bring her out. And then it kind of fades out with the song to them receiving the phone call that Gran's in the hospital. And I just thought, if this were, you know, like a lot of those movies you were referencing before, Joe, like those really early shot on video movies, it would be like scene to scene to scene to scene. Okay, like here we are. Now we're at the house, and now the henchmen are knocking on the door, and the show's over, and now it's the, you know, now we're back in the club and we're getting the call. But they do a lot of things to make it feel like a movie with a larger budget. And I also want to just kind of give a shout out right now to the performance of William Stanford Davis as Big Pear. I think he's having a lot of fun. He's committed to this performance, and he's pretty convincing and pretty menacing. Like, I think you're right. When Little Mikey's first introduced, it almost feels like a weird insert shot. It's like in Cruising when that guy in the gold thong comes out and slaps Al Pacino in the face.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm not sure why this is here. But then you see him come in later and you're like, oh, this is just a really interesting, heavy character that I haven't really seen played that way before. But I really like William Stanford Davis's performance here. Everybody here, I think, is recognizing that they're making a cheap movie, but it feels like they all sort of like have faith in the product, and they're all trying to elevate the material, which I can appreciate. They're not always successful per se, but they're always trying to elevate the material.
I mean, I'll say that's kind of something that I think separates a Ted Nicolau film from a lot of these others, is that so many of these Full Moon movies have very non-committal sort of blank characters, especially their male protagonists. They're almost always like they don't make any kind of character choices, and so they don't make any kind of impression. Whereas Russell Richardson playing Kwame is like he's got integrity, and he's got, you know, some anger, and he's got some motivation. Like, you know, it's a big performance, but I actually appreciate them going bigger than just not making a choice or not trying, which is what so many of the actors in Full Moon movies just tend to do. So I think that's just a smart choice. And I think it's a fun performance. I really like almost all of the performances, I think, work in this movie. Weirdly, kind of similar almost to another 1999 movie that we talked about, Blood Dolls. The doll, the tiny terror at the center of this movie, is almost the least interesting thing that's happening in this film.
And that's what you want, you know. That's the dressing of it, you know what I mean? But it's much better when the story is strong. And that, and just like you guys said, which is, it's very strong here, but especially between the characters. And just to Jared's point, you know, with the direction and the way that they're making the film, like Ted Nicolau is an established director, and when he was making films with Empire Pictures, those were like large budget, I'm going to put this in the movies, like movies, you know? So he still had that kind of sentiment, I think, behind the camera. Even if it is on video, he still treated it all like it was a big film. And everybody that was on set really cared about it. And I feel like that's why it's as good as it is.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, they had a little bit of budget, but they were really putting their all into it. And this was the launch movie for Alchemy. So I feel like there was a lot of excitement there. That's what drove this movie to be so good, for sure.
Yeah. Not unlike Rawhead Rex, the kind of static nature of the Tiny Terror itself, and the way that it's I think there's some, like we mentioned before, there's some cool lighting, but I also think this creature design would have benefited from being kept sort of in the shadows early on, like, you know, in the scene in Gremlins where the, like, the science, the biology or science teacher is putting his hand under the table to, and we yet as an audience haven't seen the gremlin creature reveal of what they really look like. I think this movie could have used that a little bit. Like, we know what it is because it's been explained to us narratively, but have it be sort of in the shadows. And then I think you can try to effectively frame and light the limitations of the ragdoll to make it more effective. I mean, they basically were like, when they were coming up with the design, this is a story about people of color. This is a Cajun Creole, you know, Nolan's story. And so they kind of landed on, oh, you've seen Trilogy of Terror. Oh, you've seen an Aunt Jemima bottle. Mm. Put those two things together.
You saw Tales from the Hood, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
True. And so I do think, like, it would have benefited for if it was hidden a little bit more early on, and then some of that red accent lighting would have been a little bit more effective. I do think, again, you have to look at it and say, this is a limitation of the budget. This is them doing what they can with the time and resources that they had. And if you're an aficionado of movies like this, you can get behind it. If you're your average movie viewer, you're going to laugh or roll your eyes at this. But we like to approach all the properties from a place of love.
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. And comparatively to other Full Moon movies, I think this, the way that the Ragdolls utilize this movie, is way better than a lot of other projects. Big time.
And speaking of the ragdoll, this is the scene where the ragdoll is officially turned into this killing machine.
Yeah.
Because Kwame wants revenge for what happened to his grandmother, as you would want yourself, honestly. I kind of feel for him a lot here. But he goes down the wrong path. He makes a very bad decision.
We get this great scene where he basically used some fucking voodoo magic mon.
Fucking voodoo magic mon.
And he conjures the Shadow Man. And the Shadow Man literally pops up and they have a conversation.
Sucks all the light out of the room.
Which is pretty great. I love that. And I love that kind of bringing the voodoo element in and really going in on it, you know?
A lot better done here than in one of our first episodes ever, Venom.
Yes.
That shit the bed big time on that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they do themselves a favor with making the rules of the ragdoll are very clear and very simple. You know, they don't try and overcomplicate it, and they don't try and build too much lore around this character. This is just a character that will kill for you, but it will have to take something that you love at the same time. You know, there's always a cost to everything that you're doing, and you need to keep that in mind. So it is a character that's built in with some stakes, and we don't need to like waste a lot of time trying to track what it's doing. It's very clear in like a kind of classic fable style.
Just to your point, Steve, it, you know, it's a vessel. Just like in the beginning of the movie, we saw it could be a dress for all intents and purposes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It could be anything.
You get that kind of, I wouldn't say child's play, like Steve said, more Trilogy of Terror. Sure. Or I'm not sure if Jared or Steve said that, but more like Trilogy of Terror, like the Zuni fetish doll kind of thing.
I do think it's kind of funny that Kwame just basically is like, just take whatever. Just save my grandma.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. And the only caveat that he does say
that is the caveat
is that if grandma gets hurt, the fucking deal is kaput. And yeah. Shadow Man's like, okay, no problem.
It's been a pleasure doing business with your whole family over these years. Yeah,
I like that line.
Yeah, it's a good one.
That's just a trope that always works for me. I love a good making a deal with the devil movie. And, I love this idea of just like summoning a shadowy figure, but it is a monkey's paw effect on everything. You know, it's a simple setup, but it always kind of works for me.
Oh, Mr. Kwame, this is the other place.
Yeah, no, just to your point. I mean, like sometimes the simplest stories are the best ones, you know, and you have room to play around in that, especially adapting it to this sort of quote unquote urban horror version of that. You know what I mean?
I mean, speaking of, this ragdoll instantly goes into action. Oh, goes man. Right after
Big Gene.
Big Gene, yeah.
This ragdoll's fucking scratching on the record player? I thought that was one of the funniest things.
This ragdoll also sounds like a freaking cat.
Oh, it's like
it definitely makes cat sounds. Yeah, for sure.
Every time. I was thinking of Uninvited.
You know, remember in E.T. when Elliot first sees E.T. and E.T. runs away scared? Like, that's the sound effect. It's just playing every time. Yeah.
It's disturbing.
It's creepy, though. It's creepy, though.
But it kills this guy by just, like, jumping at his face and just gnawing on it, and it just cuts to black. It's like, all right, you don't have a ton of budget.
Skins
that worked.
Him. Skins his face.
Right well, you find that out later. They don't show that, but...
No, you got to compare this to, like, Killjoy from the following year, which is a character that is, like, pretty overcomplicated and kind of confusing, because it is a doll brought to life, but it's also a clown, and he also has control of an alternate dimension, and if he brings you over there and kills you there, you die in this dimension. There's just kind of too much shit going on with him, and Ragdoll is just very clean, clear, efficient, gets to the point, and I think that it's a much more compelling movie for that reason.
Absolutely. I totally forgot that Killjoy was a clown at first. Man, I got to go back and revisit those.
I've never seen it.
I think it might be good, worth it to check out. The first one. I don't know. Right. We'll see.
It had moments, you know. It's cool that it's and that's very much in this like alchemy vein of trying to do cheap horror kind of led by people of color, which is still something that's rare. It's still something that doesn't happen very often, and it's something that, you know, needs to happen more often.
Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah, in the first movie, it's Angel Vargas is the guy who plays Killjoy, and he brings a lot in that performance. We talk in our episode that we dropped about that movie about some of the ways the way the character is revealed in some really clever shots that are actually pretty effective and similar to some of the things in this movie, like go above and beyond what you would expect for them to be able to pull off. I mean, this movie is a lot more successful than Killjoy. I mean, Killjoy does have the CGI bullet spray, which is one of the absolute most laughable effects you'll ever see in your life.
Yeah, there are a few of those.
And it's got a bunch of, like the opposite of what is happening here. A bunch of people who are giving virtually non-performances around this one person who's playing the titular Killjoy, who's vamping it up and going big and chewing the scenery, and everyone else is just stumbling to get these line readings out. It's the complete opposite there, but it is worth watching for the character design of Killjoy in that first. But I do think it's interesting that it goes from being Angel Vargas, who's a person of color playing this character in a movie in an urban setting with people of color, to Trent Haga, who's not, and he would go on to be the one who's known to be the better Killjoy, which is interesting. And I honestly feel like I'm really failing in my assignment here, because our mission statement is to be the authority on a lot of these things. I have not seen the Killjoy sequels yet. We'll cover them eventually on episodes, but that's what I hear, is that Trent Haga's, who people associate with Killjoy. And watching the first movie, I just was kind of shocked by that because I was like, oh, this guy's kind of good, actually.
I didn't even realize that they switched out for it was a white dude for the rest
the second,
of the Killjoy
movies? Yeah, in the sequel.
Interesting. Was it? It was still under Alchemy, though, was it not?
I believe Alchemy might have closed by that point. I think
there's only five Alchemy movies under the umbrella of Alchemy Pictures, and it's not. I don't think there's a Killjoy sequel in there yet.
I think Killjoy was kind of the one series that they plucked from that little era and sort of absorbed into Full Moon because it's one of their signature latter day characters.
So we get the second killing. Lil Mikey gets it this time. And again, Lil Mikey's only in a couple scenes in this movie.
Yeah.
But like this, I think, is his other big scene than from his entrance scene, you know? And I love this because, again, like the way that he can be funny about it, but also be like terrifying at the same time.
Well, it's actually the third kill because.
Is it the third kill?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. But like, because Jim gets killed first with this fucking this nail, this long like voodoo doll nail.
Oh, no, it's a knitting needle.
Oh, a knitting needle.
Yeah, that one that stabbed Michael Myers right in the neck there. Yeah.
No. But you get stabbed in the foot and then stabbed to death by it. And that's what leads to the Mikey scene because Kwame and his girlfriend, they come up and they're like about to go inside to have sex. And they find this dead body, their best friend.
Right on the stoop.
And they assume it's Big Pear getting revenge. Mm-hmm. And so then he runs to the hospital thinking, oh, shit, grandma. And then there's Mikey with the fucking gun. Sit down. Sit the fuck down, motherfucker.
But yeah, so this is creepy, too, because like for whatever reason, the ragdoll is under the Grand's blanket.
She thought she was Leech Woman for a second.
But it ends up like jumping at Mikey and like just tearing his face up. And the makeup, there's not a lot of makeup in this movie, like as far as like gore effects and stuff like that. But this one's really good because this thing like chews this dude's face up and like his lip is coming off and is like he's got a big chunk out of his cheek and stuff. And he ends up getting stabbed to death by a bunch of hypodermic needles.
And it's also like poetic because right before that, he's like, I can't stand needles. So, yeah. Of course,
yeah.
It was funny that he tossed that out kind of like just before he died. That wasn't like a lingering character trait of him. We just learned 30 seconds before he gets stabbed by a bunch of needles that he would prefer to not be stabbed by a bunch of needles.
I also like how we kind of get to this next series of events because Kwame picks up this guy's gun, Little Mikey's gun, as he's getting killed. So the cops think, oh, you killed him. So now him and everyone can get arrested or getting interrogated. And there's this kind of funny scene with this lady cop going after Lewis. Like, oh, yeah, Lewis, you've just been running your mouth this whole time. He's like, I don't even know why I'm here.
He's like, you did it, didn't you? You killed him. Just fess up.
He's like, killed who?
But like, Kwame gives this whole thing. He's like, all right, it was a rag doll that killed little Mikey. And they're
statement.
Like, well, get the fuck out of here. Like, throw the paper at him. And there's a lot of good cop, bad cop stuff here, which makes for some pretty funny shit.
Yeah, the put upon cop in Kwame's interrogation is really fucking funny. It's like they're telling the story, and that's the kind of story. If you heard it, your instinct, I feel like, would be to kind of nudge the other detective and be like, hey, you want to join me in the other room? Like, we need to talk about, like, the story that we're getting from this guy. But instead, he just, like, leans in and he's like, listen to me, you motherfucker. It's like, it's a really funny, like, line of questioning. Like, he is like, I'm just going to intimidate this guy into talking some sense. And I think he even says that phrase, even says like, I'm you're not leaving until you talk some sense to me. And it was just funny because I could just get behind, like, that's a trope we've seen a million times. And so I'm sure trying to like knock this scene out in one take, Ted Nicolau is probably like, all right. It's like, oh, the guy's like, oh, what's my motivation? He's like, oh, you're a bad cop in an interrogation. Mm. He's like, got it.
We're all bad cops here.
Yo, yeah.
That's a good line.
We need a Rumpelstiltskin or Terminator to come in here because the fucking ragdoll comes in like John McClane through the ceiling.
Well, real quick, I think it's so great, though, too. Yeah. Like, they're ecstatic about the fact that Lil Mikey and Big Gene are dead, but they're like, we need a better story to seal this deal. Like, we can't give that. We can't turn this into the chief,
right, the
and
cops,
everything be
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Then they all get murdered by the ragdoll. Well, Lewis and the one lady cop, which I don't know why that doesn't count for the curse or for the Shadow Man, but I guess because it's not his friend. It's just an extra victim just for the hell of it.
A little something extra got in the way, you know? Picked up that loose change.
Shadow Man, that's extra for him. Yeah. That's his snack for later.
So now that's it. We're down to Big Pear and Tisha, man. And if Big Pear dies, Tisha dies. So right. We have to go try to save Big Pear with like a protection spell.
Right. So do a circle, a magic circle that if you stand in, then supposedly the ragdoll can't get to you.
Well, again, he does the magic. He makes him like strip down. And he's like painting sigils and stuff on him with like chicken feathers and stuff. And they're trying to make this concoction.
Yeah.
And the ragdoll ends up coming there. He's trying to shoot it with a shotgun and like goes to grab it and falls out of like the protection
it's
circle.
It's like one of those commercials where it's like people using products like crazily, like, oh, this hose doesn't work right. And like flying all over the place. It's like, how did he trip? Anyway, the ragdoll stabs the shit out of him off screen.
Yeah. Oh, he's like in an elevator because they go to leave.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just stabbing him. It reminded me of Strung Along, the Tales from the Crypt episode with the ventriloquist. Not the ventriloquist. He's like a puppeteer, like a Howdy Doody kind of dude.
But now that Pear got killed, basically they're like, fuck Tisha, what are we going
to
do?
We have to save her. What can I do?
You Grandma know? Wakes up. It's like the end of Dogma. It's like, ooh! And she's like, oh my God, what have you done?
So they end up going back to the house, and in the last-ditch effort, they're trying to do this protection spell, and Gran comes in, and she's like, you don't know what you've done. You know, you fuck with the Shadow Man, and now he's going to take everything from you, and you're an idiot because you promised him all this stuff. You didn't even bargain with the guy.
Literally. Was that a Ghostbusters reference?
It was. It was totally a Ghostbusters reference. And Gran has this great plan to, like, put a glamour on herself and Tisha to kind of switch bodies, and the caveat to the contract with the Shadow Man was nothing happens to Gran.
Right.
So they end up like switching again with some kind of glamour.
Yeah.
And the ragdoll ends up killing Gran, spoilers, and that's how they get out of the contract. So she gives her life for Kwame and Tisha.
Which I was thinking about that. What if you like break up? And now your grandma's still fucking dead.
Ooh, yeah. And also,
sorry, like, it didn't work out. Sorry about your grandma.
That's also putting a strain on the relationship, too, you think, maybe? I don't know.
I mean,
yeah, he brings it up every time they get in an argument. He's just like, hey, remember the time I fucking sacrificed my grandma for you, you bitch?
Exactly.
I guess everything's okay because then they start a duo. Now, instead of sounding like DMX, he's like Usher, kind of.
I don't know. There's a couple songs in there where I think they're ripping off Ghostface Killer, but I don't know.
Maybe.
And now their band name makes more sense because before they were KT Bounce, you know, Kwame Tisha Bounce, you know, that was their band name. But they had two other guys. So why weren't they getting initials, you know? So
yeah, where's Jim and Lewis?
KTLG Bounce, I guess, was a little too much. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Steve, right. That was in the contract. They just didn't read the fine print. There was an asterisk there.
Fools, money on the table.
And it wraps up like that, man. And I you know, I kind of appreciate that.
Well, he's also singing a song about how he's sorry and he fucked up, basically.
Yeah.
Doesn't get arrested, but he feels bad.
It's done way better than another movie that comes out the next year, and that's Leprechaun in the Hood, which I do like, but
it is trying to do the same concept, taking a totally different angle at it.
Which I'm convinced totally aped this and like just applied it to a leprechaun, and it doesn't work nearly as well. And they had Ice-T in the damn movie.
He makes the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gotta, it's funny, you brought up Leprechaun in the Hood, and I'm like, every time someone brings that movie up, or Leprechaun in Space, or any of those, I'm like, that's a series I need to sit down with again. It's been too long, and it's like, I can remember beats from that first movie, but it's like, those sequels have become just titles that exist to me now. Like, I really don't remember specifics about them, and I gotta just, it's like, I, you know, Steve and I do this show, so we obviously don't value our time.
Oh, no, it's worthless.
I can definitely sit down and watch like 5 Leprechaun movies, you know, and think nothing of it, because it's like I watch 4 movies sometimes in a week in prep for this show. And it's, I'm thinking like every once in a while, I'm like, oh, do I have time for that? I'm like, yeah, you definitely have time for that. You can make time for some of the stuff we sit down to watch and take notes on. I definitely have time to put, you know, Leprechaun in the Hood on the background as a refresher course.
It's definitely worth it. Just go down the list.
Well, 1 and 2, I think, are the shining stars of the series. Yeah. 4 is just insane. And Leprechaun in the Hood is just a worse version of this movie, in my opinion.
I guess if you want to connect the dots, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So yeah, guys, so what we do on our show is the movie on the shelf or in the dumpster? I know you guys are very diplomatic about your opinions on films, and that's okay. So where are we putting this, fellas? You guys can go first.
Sure. Yeah, I will put this on the shelf. I think this is this one kind of surprised me. Full disclosure, I was not super looking forward to watching this one. I feel like I always cringe a little bit when these movies start to tackle race. Like, there's a movie called Ooga Booga on our list that I am just absolutely dreading. I don't know how we're going to cover it, and it's giving me future anxiety. But this did not turn out to be one of those. This was not cringy. This was not embarrassing in any way or insensitive. I think they struck a nice balance. I think they've got some pretty good performances, some stronger plotting and characterization than most of the movies of this era. And it's just kind of hampered by being a very, very, very cheap looking movie. But, you know, hey, what are you going to do? I think it's solid for what it's trying to do.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, Steve. I think this belongs on the shelf. I'm putting it on the shelf. And I kind of echo what you're saying. I think you have to get past, you know, how the film looks. I think you need to get past it's never going to really transcend looking as cheaply as it does kind of from frame one. But if you're willing to look past that and you're willing to look at what they were able to make on such a tight schedule and such a hampered budget, it's pretty interesting that they managed to shoot. We didn't talk about the other performance in the movie by the duo Voodoo.
Mm-hmm. I thought they were the best part. I thought they were the best, the act.
Yeah. And like Ted Nicolau likes to shoot music because, I mean, Bad Channels has all of those interstitial musical numbers in it with those bands. And I feel like Terrorvision kind of plays like a big extended music video in a lot of ways. And he's really good at that. He understands that. And I think those scenes, like, they could be ultra cringy, and they're really not. They're handled kind of delicately. And I think all of the performers make the characters kind of interesting and unique from one another, where they don't blend together and you can tell them apart. Like, when it comes to big heavies, like, there's no confusing Lil Mikey and Big Pear. Like, no. You're just not going to confuse those two people. It's just such two energetic but very holistically different performances. And I just think that, like, they made a pretty good little movie that's hampered by, you know, some production issues. But I think, like, comparatively to some of the things we've watched you want to talk about being in a dumpster. Like, I feel like we've scraped, you know, the bottom of that barrel a few times. And sure, this isn't there. I mean, I'm happy to say that I find this to be, like, either upper middle echelon Full Moon or lower upper echelon. Like, I haven't really decided sure which, but it's somewhere kind of towards the middle. And similarly to Steve, when I first went to put it on, I almost immediately was like, well, this is going to be somewhere in the very bottom. Like, yeah, all I'm going to do is try to find something complimentary to say. And it wasn't that hard. It was pretty easy, actually, to find some things to admire in this movie. So, shelf.
Yeah, this is shelf easy. This is one of those films, when you watch it, at least in my opinion, that I'm sitting there saying, huh, why didn't I watch this like 10 years ago? Or at this point, I guess over 20 years ago. Holy cow. Actually, I wonder how close we're getting to that 25th anniversary now that I think about it. Mm. But what can I say that we didn't already say? The cinematography is really good in this one. All the characters are pretty likable, even the kind of the bit characters. The other members of the band are pretty interesting. And like Big Pear, very good villain. And Kwame is a character that, in other films, this trope, as it has been done 1,000 times, doesn't always land for me. But in this one, I kind of felt for him. There's one scene where I thought he kind of lost me for a minute when they find out that the one guy's dead and he kind of freaks out. But I understood what they were trying to convey. It was now real to him. Before, it was just maybe it was in his head or whatever, but now it's actually happening, and I kind of like that, actually.
And somebody died by his hand, so it was, like, a little shocking.
It made me think, even though not even comparable, but Death Note a little, like, when Light finally saw it work, he's like, ooh, and he started killing everybody. But yeah, this was really good. Definitely on the shelf, and I would revisit this one again for sure.
Yeah, man, it is on the shelf for sure. It's been on the shelf, you know what I mean? I remember renting it as a kid and really liking it and thought it was so different for that time, especially because, again, we have an all-black cast here. It's the quote-unquote urban horror of the Full Moon franchise, the stretch there,
yeah.
You know? And coming back to it now for the show, I was really excited because I was hoping that it held up, and it did. It did gangbusters. And we try to highlight independent films on this show, especially the good ones. And I'm happy to say that I'm going to echo Jared and say, like, this for Full Moon in the 90s, especially the later 90s, this is definitely up there for me, 100%. I think it's executed really well. You got Ted Nicolau just crushing it. And I really think not only like the strong casting of everybody, because there was a pretty rigorous casting process for this, because they wanted the best of the best since it was the flagship title for Alchemy. But having Ted in there and just really bringing it all together and really enriching the story visually and working with everybody to make it the best that it could be, I think it really works really well and it holds up. I love the voodoo angle. I always love a good voodoo angle. And I'm a little rubber monster guy, so you got me with Ragdoll, even though that's not necessarily what the movie's mostly about, sure, like we talked about before. But when she does pop up, it's always nice to see her. And she doesn't overstay her welcome, right? She's in and out.
That's Ted, because Ted is not a Tiny Terrors guy.
No.
He admitted so much in, you know, talking to us also. He said, Charlie loves these Tiny Terrors. He said, that's not really my thing, but... You know, that's why I think the actual Ragdoll herself is so, I don't want to say underutilized, because I mean, when we think about this design and prop and that they're using, I think it's utilized about as much as you can, but it's not front and center in the movie, because it really, I think Ted Nicolau wanted it to be a little more of a human story than a Tiny Terror story. That's his stamp, I think, on it.
Absolutely. And it really works like that. And I think we even, not the same, but it's almost similar, like Pinocchio's Revenge kind of
thing.
Oh,
yeah.
In that that's ballpark, where that's not necessarily a Tiny Terror movie, but it features one. And this features a Tiny Terror, but it's not necessarily a Tiny Terrors movie.
I'm sure
Charlie was like, ah, shit.
When he saw Pinocchio's Revenge?
No, Ragdoll. Ragdoll, of course. This movie is fantastic, and if you haven't checked it out, it's on Tubi. If you want to go check it out for sure. Give it a spin. I think it's about time you check it out for some latter Full Moon. But yeah, guys, thank you so much for coming to hang out with us in the dumpster. And can you tell everybody where to find the Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks podcast?
Sure. So the show is Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks. If you search those words in that order, you will find the show on all social media. On Instagram, we are at puppetmasters_castlefreaks. You can follow me personally at @_giallo_Jerry or Steve at @MinotaurMatador. And the show is on X and Threads and Blue Sky and YouTube and all of those places where you can find any podcasting content. So if you were a fan of this conversation and you're a fan of Charles Band and Full Moon and all that stuff, just know there is a show out there devoted only to that. And so that people who found it and that's their thing, they've been super into it. Steve has another show, though, which is I'm sure your listeners would like to hear about, too. So, Steve, what else can you plug?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also on a show called Cinemarcade. That's Cinema Arcade, both one word together. It's a show where we watch a movie and then play the video game based on that movie. Kind of contrast and compare and see whether they add or detract from each other. It's been a lot of fun. I'm going to record an episode of that in a few minutes here even. So yeah, I'm doubling up on my schedule today. But yeah, you can find Cinemarcade wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome, guys. And we just want to say thank you so much again for coming on the show. And we had a blast. Go check out the Demonic Toys 2 episode over on Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks. And hopefully we'll cross paths again. But this was super fun doing Ragdoll with you guys.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah, we will meet at the bottom of a dumpster again at some point. It's bound to happen.
It's hard to get Jared out of it.
It really is.
Got to get a shovel to dig him out.
It's all right. You can hang with us. No problem.
With that being said, if you want some more Movie Dumpster content, head over to patreon.com/moviedumpster, where you can sign up for as low as $2 a month to get yourself an ad-free version of the audio version of this show. And we also have tons of different behind-the-scenes goodies, including mini-sodes, live watch-alongs, commentary tracks, and a bunch more other Movie Dumpster content.
Sure does. And if you could do us a favor, if you're watching on YouTube, please like this video and share it. Or if you're listening on your favorite podcast app, leave us a 5-star review if you're digging the show. That means more to us than buying anything from the store or signing up for the Patreon. It helps us get out of the bottom of the dumpster and into more eardrums, eyeballs, everything in between. It really, really helps the show, and we'd really appreciate it if you could do that for us.
And if you want to keep up with news on the show, you can follow us at Movie Dumpster on social media or head over to MovieDumpsterPodcast.com, where we've got a list of our upcoming events, including Monster Mania, Tapes from the Crypt, and other things in your future. Head over to MovieDumpsterPodcast.com for all that information, plus what episodes we got coming out, Patreon updates, and everything else Movie Dumpster.
So that's it. That's Ragdoll from 1999, directed by Ted Nicolau. I'm Joel Escola.
I'm Sean O'Rourke.
I'm Jared Hornbeck.
I'm Steve Gunley.
Thanks for visiting the dumpster.